Okay, so today is June 15th, 2022. We are at Richard Wayne's hangar in his office. He's being interviewed, so he'll be the narrator of this tape. And then my name is Reed Beeson, and I will be the interviewer. Nobody else is present, and this tape will be used for research purposes for an exhibit at the Pioneer Air Museum, as well as it will be stored at the Rasmussen Library at the University of Alaska Fairbanks for research purposes there as well. Okay, so let's get started. So why don't just start off, you can just introduce yourself for any future listeners, and as well as just tell me about your first experience flying.
My name is Richard Wayne. I'm the youngest son of Noel Wayne, aviation pioneer. He was preceded only by Ben Allison in Alaska, and for a while was the only one in the northern part of the territory at that time. So did a lot of pioneering flights. I grew up. Our house in Fairbanks was about a little over a block from Weeks Field, which was the early airport in Fairbanks, long before the international here was open, and basically hung out there after school and all summer, infatuated with airplanes and the early pilots kind of going. I was born in 35, and so, in the 40s I was pretty active at the airport. And I learned to fly off the airport in 1951 when I soloed. I got my pilot's license in the morning and my driver's license in the afternoon, and shot landings and so forth at Weeks Field. They had closed the tower because they moved it out here, but they hadn't opened up the airport yet, so that was kind of an adventure to fly with other airplanes with no control tower. But I feel very fortunate to have had the childhood I had and grow up around aviation. This is an interview, I understand, about Sam White, he lived in a little house just across the street from our house, so our family spent a lot of time together. Sam was, we call him Uncle Sam. He was probably as close to being a brother of my dad and my uncle as anybody. Super respected by just about everybody. Young men like me would go to see him and hear stories and influence them in not only flying, but his philosophy on things and what's right and what's wrong. So I felt very, very, very close to Sam, and as my brother did. It's been a privilege to have known him.
All right. So yeah, like Richard said, this interview is going to be about Sam White, and so that's what the exhibit that we're going to be making is for. So why don't you tell me about the first time you met Sam?
I really can't remember. Like I said, I grew up across the street from him, so I was pretty small. I think, I don't remember when we moved to that house, but I was probably 4 or 5 years old, and it just, Sam was always there. So I really can't focus on, when I met him. When I was a little guy, sometimes I'd get up in the morning and for everybody else did, and Sam was an early riser, and I'd go knock on the door and he'd invite me in and sometimes feed me breakfast, even though my mom was upset over that because she had breakfast ready. I said, "Oh, I've already eaten at Sam's." Just early childhood memories, and as I got older, got to know him more and better and appreciate him. And a lot of flying experiences that he had, and heard the stories, and he had a lot of them. He was a good storyteller. Had a big booming voice, and I think in the book, I wrote the preface to his book for Jim Reardon, and I think that I used the term Sam was a giant of a man. I think both my brother and I kind of referred to him as that. He was giant in size, in voice, and principles. Probably the most principled person that both my brother and I ever had the pleasure of getting to know, and we learned to live by a lot of his. He was a World War I vet, among other things, and didn't talk about that too much. He did talk about his early days in Maine and driving a Lombard log hauler, which was quite a story. So, you know, many, many stories that he told us and that we're familiar with.
So what was that like, getting to know him a little bit better when you were older? How did your relationship
Well, ironically, in 1955, I started commercial flying up a place called Bettles on the Kaikuk River, right? It's the south part of the Brooks Range. And going to school in the summer times, I would fly the bush, what we called the bush, which was in the airline, Wien Airlines, which I grew up in. They had the main line, they called it, which was the larger airplanes, DC-3, C-46, later F-27s. excuse me. And over time, probably too young, I was made chief bush pilot. And one of my pilots was Sam White, that worked for me. And I would give him his check rides, and that was kind of awkward, I guess, because I was just a kid on his knee when he was flying. But I tried to treat him with respect, and we kept him on the airline until he was in his 70s. And the place we had him based, they changed that, and so he retired from the airline at that time, which was hard on him. It gave him a purpose in life, I guess.
Right. Yeah. So you said that he was a pretty good storyteller. What was your favorite story that he'd tell?
Oh, there were so many. Told a lot of bear stories. You know, he was a guy who, my brother Merrill and I, we'd call him the Daniel Boone of Alaska. You know, he grew up in Maine, and as a teenager, he was a big game guide, and you know, fought in World War I. He didn't want to talk about it much. And then he came to Alaska and worked for the Boundary Commission, you know, surveying the boundary. And also, he worked for U.S. Geological Survey for many years before he started flying, doing triangulation around the state. In fact, I've got some of his old maps, the triangle map, and I haven't figured out a place to give them to. But, you know, when they're surveying, they get basic places, and then they shoot off of there when they need to survey something. So he walked all over Alaska and canoed. And then later, he became U.S. Fish and Wildlife agent and traveled all over the interior. He was the only game management in the whole interior for many years, and he had to cover that and try to convince well, not only the white people, but the natives on how to conserve the game. If you kill off all the beaver in an area, you're not going to gain more and that type of thing. And he was very good at, I think the natives respected him. He treated them well. So the stories were just never ending, just about a bear or wolves or childhood, being a steersman on the log, the Lombard log hauler. People don't know what that is, but basically it was like a train engine with a big ski in front that that you steered it with, and it would haul I don't know how many cars of or flat cars on sleds of lumber. You look at pictures of it, you think this little thing could pull all that. And what was amazing about it is there's no brakes on it. And so when you went over, when you went down a hill, they would put hay on the track, and the steersman had to negotiate that thing when it was kind of out of control. And he said they lost a lot of steersmen, and they got paid very well. That's why he did it, because the mortality rate was pretty high. Those are the kind of stories we heard, but a lot of animals and hunting and flying stories. He had a lot of them. I can tell you about a couple that were very significant to both my brother and I, because we loved him so much, and we're concerned about him. You want to get into that now or later, whatever you want to do.
So yeah, one of those. You said one of those stories.
Well, they're all in his book. The one that early one that was of concern. He was flying for the Wien Airlines then, and he was flying a Stinson, and the rigging wasn't right on the skis. And when he got in a turbulence, the skis, one ski went straight up and down, and put the airplane in a spiral, and he was going to crash. Except in the process, the other ski went down, and now he could keep it straight, but he was losing altitude rapidly. So he was able to make it to a place called Circle City up on the Yukon and crashed wide open with the skis down on this runway, and it broke him up pretty bad. He survived it, but he had broken hips and one thing and another, and my dad flew up to bring him home. He wouldn't have anybody but my dad fly him home. So we remember seeing him in his bed and worried about him. The worst one was he went on his own as a bush pilot, and based out of Ruby. He had a L5. The museum now has the fuselage of that airplane that he had. a Stinson L5. It was was built for the military as a Lassen aircraft, but it worked pretty good as a bush plane. And he had a cabin in Ruby, and it was about 40 below, I guess, and he was flying, and he came home and had a Coleman lantern, and he bumped it up, probably too much pressure, and then hung it up, and a little cabin with a stove going, it heated that gas to the point where it exploded, and fortunately he had long wool underwear on, but he was burned very seriously, mostly in his hands and above the neck and everything, and pretty bad shape. And we got the word, and my dad again went and picked him up, flew him to town, and made Marilyn and I just sick to look at him. He was very badly burned. He over time recovered from that and worked his hands, which were very stiff, and was able to fly again. But those were two very significant events that I remember, and it upset my older brother and me a lot. So those were a couple of bad ones. He had other, you know, like all pilots, other experiences, you know, just yeah, you know, in the days of no airports and float flying and ski flying, and there was always a lot of adventures. I came later, you know, he was flying in the 30s and 40s, and I started flying in 1955, bush flying, but I was still flying the Norsemans and Beavers and the early 180s and all that. And so I experienced scud running and delivering mail. And the early days, we served, I think it was 135 communities, you know, they're anywhere from larger ones to very small villages, and I think less than half of those places had a runway, so we had to find a lake or a river gravel bar or land on a river and skis or something. So there was, even when I did it, it was adventure, but I had better equipment, more modern. And Sam and, well, particularly my dad, had the old, very early biplanes with earlier engines that weren't reliable. And Sam came a little bit later and had better engines, but still biplanes, open cockpit. And I think what was significant about Sam, and even why he learned to fly, he became very good friends of my dad and my uncle Ralph. And he would, you know, he traveled all over the interior in dog teams and snowshoes. And Fort Yukon was one place that he went a lot because it was a central point for that upper Yukon. And the trappers had to get their beavers tagged and that type of thing. So he would trek up to Fort Yukon, which was about 140 miles. And he'd hear this noise and hear an airplane would go, and pretty soon it would come back. And he got to thinking about that, that he, you know, how much more area he could cover. And kind of the rest is history in it. He couldn't get the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Everything was the federal then. There was no state. It was a territory, so it was a U.S. Fish and Wildlife that he worked for. And he kind of opposed to them that they buy him an airplane and he learned to fly so that he could cover more ground faster. And they didn't see the feasibility of it at that time. And so on his own time, with his own money, he bought an airplane. And it wasn't the Swallow that he bought. It was a, I'm trying to think of the name of it. It was a parasol. In other words, it had an upper wing. It's in the book, the name of the airplane. But it didn't work out very well. And he sold that and bought the Swallow, which did work out. I think my dad went to Valdez, where it came in, and flew back with him. But basically, mostly my uncle and my dad taught him how to fly. And he was always very beholden to him. And I think the other thing that was so significant, I think about a lot, was the bond between Sam and the Ween family was just unbreakable. He would do anything for the family, and we'd do anything for him. The other thing about Sam was worldly things didn't mean a thing to him. People from Maine, he was very popular in Maine, kind of a legend there too. And they would send him things that they knew he liked. He loved ginger ale, and he always had ginger ale. And he liked the maple syrup from Maine, so they would ship up gallons. And he would just give a lot of it to other people. And his wife, Mary, was just a wonderful gal. He met her in Fort Yukon. She was a nurse. And they were just a great couple. She was not an outgoing person or an outdoors person at all, but she dearly loved Sam and kept the home fires burning and very active in her church, just a wonderful lady. And she was the same way. If somebody gave her a Christmas present and she didn't need it, she'd give it to somebody else. And I was the executor of his estate when he died, and there just wasn't much there at all. He didn't have a lot of savings or anything. He was one of those kind of old school of I don't need any more than I need to live on, you know. And just an extremely generous person on top of everything else.
All right, so moving to what you mentioned, his philosophy on things, in Jim Reardon's book that we've been referencing about Sam White, you mentioned in the preface you wrote that he had a philosophy about the law that maybe made him unpopular to some when he was enforcing the game laws. Could you maybe explain and expand on what you mean by that?
Yeah, that was one of his principles. where he got in trouble and ultimately left Fish and Game was when the military came up here. They expected to not have to adhere to federal laws, and Sam got crosswise with him, and he was not supported by his superiors in enforcing the law, you know. So that was one issue. And then you had trappers, early trappers, white people, and you had the natives that all, you know, he was the first one to enforce it, and they didn't like it, you know. He did the best he could and to convince people that it was for their own good, because you wipe out the moose in the valley or with a beaver or muskrats or whatever you do, they're not going to come back. And so I think he was dearly loved by for what he was and who he was by many people, but a lot of people didn't like him because he enforced the law. They would never be subject to bribes or anything. He did, though, I will say this, he did, when people needed the meat, natives and so forth, living off the land, he recognized that, and they've been doing it for centuries, that, you know, I guess he, you can say he turned his head, but he basically understood what the laws and rules were about, and they weren't about those people, you know. They were more about, with those people, don't kill the game until there's no more. It's just like having a cattle ranch, you know. You gotta keep improving the herd and all that. So, yeah, I've known trappers and people that hated the ground he walked on, you know. But I also know that they were not used to abiding by anybody's rules.
And then in terms of Sam as a person over the time, you know, the decades maybe that you knew him, how did you see him change as a person over time?
I think that's the one thing about Sam, there was no change. You couldn't change him. He, right was right and wrong was wrong, period. I mean, I don't think today with the way the world is now, with our youth and what's happening, it would be very hard for Sam to survive in it. He had a code, you know, and it was what he was taught and lived by. He wasn't a hypocrite in any way. Like I said, he was extremely generous and loved nothing better than for my dad and my brother and I to go hunting with him, which we did a few times. There's a lot of young people in town, most of them would be pilots, that view Sam the way I do. He was extremely influential to them and their life.
All right. And then we mentioned some of his planes earlier, the Stinson L5 as well as the Swallow TP. Did Sam ever talk about the planes, or yeah, relate to me how Sam would talk about the different planes that he owned?
Yeah, he, you know, one of the airplanes that we got early on was a Cessna 170. And one thing about Sam is he carried enough emergency gear that he could land anywhere and put up a tent and a stove and be very comfortable. He'd be more happy there than if you had him in the finest hotel in New York. Lots of times he'd be flying and instead of bucking the snow or whatever, he'd call it on the radio, well, I'm setting down at this fork of the river and I'll be in tomorrow. These little airplanes like we had, the Cessna 170s, didn't have a very big payload. He complained about them. He said it sounded like a sewing machine when he opened the throttle because it didn't make enough noise and vibration. And he liked the airplanes like the Fairchild 71 and the Blanca and Traveler, the bigger airplanes with more skookum, you know, fit him.
All right. Did he ever mention the Swallow very much?
Not too much. No, we didn't talk about the Swallow much, other than I knew about it, and he and I think my dad talked about it. My dad talked a lot about it. My dad was a great storyteller and had so many of them and wrote up, did a lot of writing about his adventures and stories. And I don't know if you've read his book. It's a very well-written book, written by a guy by the name of Ira Harkey, who was a Pulitzer Prize winner and was a visiting professor at the university. And the folks contracted with him to write his book. I think he was very good at capturing the essence of my dad. And there's a lot in there about Sam White and the mutual respect they had, stories.
So tell me one thing that you would want the public, or really just the everyday person here in Fairbanks, one thing that you would want them to know about who Sam White was.
Well, I guess, you know, there are legends and icons, early pioneers that came, and rightly so. People like Joe Crossan, Harold Gillam. I knew both of them at Wakefield. I didn't know Eielson. He died before I was born. Bob Reeve, you know, pioneered the Aleutians. You had the boys in Southeast, Shel Simmons and Bob Ellis, and formed airlines. And, you know, you had the swashbuckling bush pilots. To me, Sam was a legend and an icon, not so much of what he did, but who he was and what he was about. And in addition to being a very good pilot and a lot of aviation experiences.
And then in terms of not just Alaska aviation, but maybe just Alaska history or industry, maybe hunting in general, in your opinion, where would Alaskan aviation be without Sam White? Where would, maybe in terms of hunting, since that was more of his specialty, but what was his biggest contribution?
I would say that it was, he was the first person ever to manage fish and game with an airplane. We don't know of anybody, even in Canada. He did it on his own, bought his own fuel. Later on, they started to see the significance of it and finance some of it. But, you know, as far as a pioneering person, that's what he pioneered. And so if you had to look at one thing that he stood out to the public, would be the first person, at least in Alaska, and we think anywhere in the world, to use the airplane and game management. Big deal.
Do you think that, or maybe what do you think the wildlife set, where would wildlife be at this point without him, without the regulation and the enforcement that he brought? What do you think might have happened?
Well, it really covers a pretty broad area. He loved moose, didn't like wolves, and the whole wolf, moose, caribou issue has always been controversial. There are wolf lovers because they're a very keen, smart animal, and nobody wants to wipe them out. But you know, through the hundreds or thousands of years, I guess, that the wolf provided a balance in nature. But if you interject man into it, when a wolf pack would move into an area and wipe out the game, and their village was living there, depending on it, they didn't like the wolves. And there was a period in the 50s, I remember it, when aerial wolf hunting was very, very prominent. I mean, a good pilot and gunner could take 100 wolves out of an area. And in fact, Lower Koyukuk had been decimated for game. There's books about how the natives starved because the wolf just wiped them out. You know, the problem with a wolf is there's a, I guess, a misconception that they only kill the weak and the wounded or something like that. But they're very efficient killers, especially with a pack. And they're very smart. And when they set out to kill a moose, they did. And in a lot of cases, they killed like a caribou or the reindeer herds just for fun. That's just what they did. They were bred to do it. And they would eat the tongue and a few of the bark parts and leave the rest of the animal there. Of course, other animals and birds, you know, lived off of them. But it, like I said, it's a very controversial thing. I think what is attempting, what they're attempting to do, and I think pretty good job of helping the balance. There's no. They do aerial surveys with for the wolves, and I know some pilots that do that for fish and wildlife, fish and game. And when it gets to be too much, and they can see an area adversely affected by them, then they authorize some killing of them. They are a magnificent animal. I've seen them from the air and watched them work, and they're very smart. So I would say, you know, as far as Sam is concerned, he helped set the standards, a lot of the standards, on game management and balance. He was big on that. You know, for a guy that no college education or didn't study, you know, fish and wildlife in college, he was out there in it all the time and could see it. Another good book that deals with that would be. The guy, Jim Reardon, wrote the book again. It's about called the Wolfman of Alaska. I'll think of his name in a minute. I met him when I was young, but he really lived out with them and did a lot of predator control. Glasser, I think his name. I'll think about it, but. If you want an interesting book about that subject, it's probably the best. There's a lot of books written, some of them, like Never Cry Wolf, was just fiction, but it became the Bible of wolf lovers. And I know that because I interviewed some Canadian fur biologists about the book, and they knew of him. And when I asked what they thought about him, they said, well, it's okay if you like fiction. I said, no, I read the book. It sounded good to me. And he said, no. He just spent a couple of weeks and wrote this thing. But this Frank Glasser is the guy's name, Wolfman of Alaska. And he watched and observed so much of the interface between the game. like I said, it's very controversial. There are people that don't want any wolves killed, and others do for different reasons.
All right. So back in the early days, you know, or 20s, 30s, navigation without instruments was a must for flying. So tell me a little bit about Sam's navigation skills. How was he as a navigator?
I think he was all right. I never heard of him getting lost. Now, when my dad first came, there were no maps. And it was in 24. There were no airports and there were no maps. Fortunately, even though he was not highly educated, I think he made it through the eighth grade before he started flying and came up here, he had a photographic mind memory on terrain. I've never seen anybody like it. And he said if I ever went anywhere, I always knew what it was about. He just seemed to have there's a mountain here, there's a river there, and I'll remember that. I was not that way at all. I got lost all the time, you know, because the maps weren't accurate for one thing. Now Sam, back to Sam, I think had some advantage of some maps, and he'd walked all over, so he had pretty good knowledge of the terrain and everything, and I don't think Sam, that ever I know, he might have struggled with navigation. You know, you get in a snowstorm, you can't see very far, but he usually get lost. But with Sam, if he didn't know where he was, he'd just land and pitch his tent. And I can tell you, when I started flying in the Brooks Range, I could fly the airplane, always could, but it was the navigating that even in the 50s, that was my nemesis, because the maps, a lot of them were not accurate. And when I started flying up north in the Brooks Range in the 50s, late 50s, they were just started aerial photo mapping of the Brooks Range. Like a map of the Brooks Range just said, it was blank. You know, you had maps of the Brooks Range, and then when you got to the North Slope, it was uncharted, they say. So you just didn't know, and you know. And so I did experience flying without a map, and I could only appreciate what my dad and others had to go through. But I've never heard of Sam getting lost or going down because he didn't know where he was.
All right. Is there anything else you would want to share about Sam White?
No, just there's so many things I could talk about, but I tend to get going on subjects too much. I think I'd like to go by my initial statement that both my brother and I characterize him as a giant of a man, and in our view, he's an icon, you know, more than Wiley Post or, you know, famous flyers. Of course, people like Jimmy Doolittle, and they're icons too, and so certainly Wiley Post was, but in a different way, we see Sam as a true icon, and a man of absolute integrity. And for his period, you know, fit the profile of what it took to survive and be respected.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions that I had for today. So,
okay.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for your knowledge about Sam. Yeah, there's nothing else.
Well, he's a fun guy to talk about, and I enjoy telling stories. My wife, you know, has characterized me as a bridge between the old and the current, because I grew up around the guys, and I wasn't a pioneer in any way. It had all been done before, but I knew those that did pioneer. And so I'm going to write my... I'm doing memoirs now. I'm not very good at it, but working on it, and some stories that I dealt with and knew of others and so forth. So doesn't come easy for me, but working on it.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to those in the future, then.
We'll see.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay.